Loud enough? Good. So I'd like to thank the organizers first for inviting me. It's very nice to be here. I'm going to talk about minimal models for calcium waves, although after hearing the first two talks, maybe I should change it to very naive or simple models for calcium waves, nonetheless. I'm a mathematician, and I heard at lunch that people faint or go dizzy at the sight of equations. So I'm going to have to apologize now for the number of equations in my talk. But if you hang on to the end, there's a couple of color movies.
There's part of the audience that doesn't mind.
Excellent. So I'm going to be talking about puffs and sparks and how they cooperate to form global signals in the form of waves. Now I'm going to basically base my talk around other people's models. These are not models I've thought up, they're other people's models. So the first model I'm going to talk about is the de Jong-Kaiser model for the IP3 receptor, because I thought in some sense it is a standard model, although what we heard today, it's probably not going to be the standard model for much longer. And I'm going to show you how to do traveling wave analysis in this model when there's diffusive transport. And I want to do this because, from my perspective, even de Jong-Kaiser is a high-dimensional, highly nonlinear model. It's hard to do any analysis on it, and I want to get down to simpler models in which one can talk about whole cell phenomena. So the simpler models I'm going for are of the type known to some people in the audience, at least, or called fire diffuse fire models. And I want to relate these back to, if you like, more complicated receptor models. And then I'm going to do a similar sort of analysis in the fire diffuse fire framework and show how it relates back to these more complicated biophysical models. And then introduce some noise into the system to show you a stochastic fire diffuse fire model. And then show you some of the physics that emerges from these models. So it's a bit, as we're in a physics institute, I thought it'd be nice to throw in some physics. So I have to make some apologies on the way. There will be lots of equations and some pictures, and these pictures are ripped off from other people's websites. Okay? So if this looks familiar to you, it's probably because you drew it. So again, I apologize in advance, but I wanted to just throw up some picture of the cell just to point at the bits I'm going to talk about and the type of phenomena I'm going to talk about. So I'm going to talk about release from internal stores in the or SR, and the receptors that are going to control that release are going to be either reanidin receptors or IP3 receptors, but in some sense, I'm going to talk about generic receptors. And the only other thing I'm going to talk about really is transport of calcium from clusters. So if there's a cluster of reanidin receptors here, there could be some calcium that emerges through the channel and diffuses and induces further release via calcium-induced calcium release. And I'm also going to talk a little bit about pumps that push calcium back into these big stores. But the phenomenon I really want to get at in this talk is making global signals from elementary events. So there are clusters of receptors that allow calcium to release from internal stores. There's transport in the form of diffusion, and then there's further release of calcium via CICR. So I'm going to start with this little discussion of this so-called eight-state de Jong-Kaiser model, and it's a model of the IP3 receptor. And basically, it's going to be described by this state X with these three little labels here, which describe whether this I'm going to really be thinking whether IP3 is bound or not, whether activating calcium is bound or not, whether inactivating calcium is bound or not. So mathematically, I'm going to describe the system with this X, and these labels here are going to be either 0 or 1, 1 if you're bound, 0 if you're unbound. And as we've heard, we probably need about three of these to make a channel, three subunits. So if I wanted to write down a mathematical model, then I'll need to define all the states of the receptor. So there are eight of them because each of these labels here can take on two values, so it's 2 to the power of 3. Then I need to define the transitions between these states, which may depend upon calcium in the system and also the IP3 in the system. And I've got conservation of probability. So although I have really eight equations to describe these, sorry, eight equations to describe these states, conservation of probability means I can get rid of one of those equations and just boil it down to 7. So if I have a large number of receptors in a cluster, it's typical to go to a sort of a population description and talk about the fraction of receptors in any given state, X, labeled by this and this. And the open probability of release in this framework is given by the cube of X110. So in some sense, I need to bind IP3, I need to bind calcium, but I don't want one in this inactivating slot, and I cube that to get my open probability of release. Yes, yeah. So you raise this earlier, is it 3 or is it 4 or what is it? But we'll just stick with 3 for today. So if we want to change it to 4 or 2, then we change that power. And I need to balance my calcium fluxes. So the rate of change of calcium, so first differential equation, I'm afraid, is the flux from the IP3 receptor, given in terms of this open probability of release, and this R1 is just a constant. This CER here is just the density of calcium in the endoplasmic reticulum, which we'll take to be a constant, and this C is just the density of calcium in the cytosol. Now I've got a constant leakage term from the ER to the cytosol, and I've got a nonlinear term describing the way in which calcium is pumped back into the stores by a circuit pump. It's pretty horrible to deal with this because I need one equation for this, how the calcium moves around in time, and then 7 others to tell me what the receptor's doing. Okay? Well, there's this nice observation by among others, John Minzel and Eugene Lee, which says, well, hang on, that this binding of IP3 is very fast, so why don't we just treat that as being a quasi-state equilibrium, and the calcium activating one is pretty fast as well compared to the inactivating one. So why don't we treat these variables as not dynamic, but just at their equilibrium values, slave to the whatever the inactivating calcium binding site is doing. So in some sense, it's a good idea to just go to a variable which just keeps track of what this last index is doing, whether this receptor is binding on its inactivating site. So we're going to lump all those things together by summing over all the states which aren't referring to this inactivating state. So this is going to sum up, these I's and J's are either 0 or 1, depending on whether you're binding or unbinding. So this H now is our new fundamental variable, and I want to rewrite the dynamics for the receptor in terms of H. And you can do that in a straightforward way, and it turns out that your open probability of release, this X110, is just proportional to H in this fashion. So P is the IP3 concentration, C is calcium, and these are K1 and K5, and all the K's that I write up are parameters of the de Young-Kaiser model. And the need then just to work out how H moves around in time, and you can do that, and it turns out that H obeys another ODE, which just depends upon, well, H is trying to, in some sense, it looks like a recovery variable you see in many excitable systems, like Hodgkin-Huxley, for example. But H is trying to relax back to its equilibrium value, which depends upon the density of calcium, at a rate-dependent, a state-dependent rate, in some sense. So why is this nice? Well, in some sense I had sort of 8 ODEs to deal with, and now I've only got 2, one for how calcium moves around and one for how this H moves around. So we can plot things in the plane to visualize the dynamics, and that's what I've done here. So in some sense this is calcium along the bottom, and this is this H, is this gating variable which describes the receptor state up the side, and these this green and this red line are when C and H stop moving. So these are the so-called Nolk lines of this planar system. And in this case, I've picked a value of background IP3 levels where the Nolk lines intercept at this point. So this is the steady state of the system, but it's unstable in this case. And so if you start the system off, say, here, it doesn't settle on this, it just evolves around on a periodic orbit, this flue line goes around and around here. Let me just say for this snapshot, there's just this one fixed point. For low IP3, this green curve intercepts over here, and there's just one stable fixed point. As it moves this way, you can see the possibility of getting 3. And as you move this way, there's 1 again, and that's unstable. And as you move this way, there's still 1, and that's stable. So I've summarized that on this little picture over here. So this is IP3 going this way, So for low IP3, one stable fixed point, the system just doesn't oscillate. There's a possibility of getting more than one fixed point, three around here, but it's a very small window of parameter space for this model. And then there's an unstable fixed point, and then we've got this periodical bit around it. This is this blue curve here. And as we increase IP3 further, the system goes back to a stable rest state. So there's a window of opportunity here for oscillations. So if you put enough IP3 on you in this model, you will get oscillations. And there's a possibility of getting three fixed points down here. So, sorry, yes? Right.
So, what are the properties of this planning?
For stability?
Yeah.
I mean, I've labeled stability on here, but I haven't really talked about basins of attraction. So the answer is I don't really know. Well, we can come back to that at the end when I do put a bit of noise in and we can see robustness to these things. So this is for one model and one set. I mean, this is the Young-Kaiser model in some sense. And the parameter values that I've used with them, the Young-Kaiser model, have been kindly made by Greg Smith. I didn't know where in the literature to look for them, but Greg provided them. Okay, so this is just, if you like, a channel, a model of a channel, or a cluster, rather. This is how it might give rise to oscillations if you put enough IP3 on the system. And we're using the language of dynamical systems to describe how that might occur. Now I want to get onto waves, so I need somehow a whole cell model. I need to stretch my point processor out into a cell model. And the way I'm going to do that is just imagine the cell is, you know, it's just a real line, stretch it out a bit. And I'm going to imagine that transport is just via diffusion. Okay? So instead of having an ODE telling you how calcium changes at a point in space, I'm going to the transport in my system is now got a diffusive term. So this term, this D is the diffusion coefficient of this model. So it's nice if I'm looking for, what I'm going to look at is I'm going to try and look for traveling waves. And these are, you can imagine, if I kick the cell at one end and there's a response, a pulse response, it may well propagate across the cell. So we may be expecting to look for solutions which move with a constant velocity. So I'm just going to run along at the speed of a wave in this system. So I'm going to go to a frame which is moving. So instead of just looking in space, I'm going to shift space by s times t. So s will be an unknown speed of a wave. But I'm still going to keep this time dependence. So I'm writing my new dynamics in terms of I'm running along at the speed of an unknown wave, but I'm keeping the time dependence. So I did have two ODEs, one for telling you how the calcium moved and one for telling you how this gating variable moved. And now I've still got two equations. The calcium one sees diffusive transport, but I'm writing everything in the traveling waveframe. So these F1s and F2s are just the non-linearities that we've seen before, you know, from calcium fluxes, from the IP3 receptor, from the leak, from the pump, and this is just the equations of motion for this gating variable. And if we want to look for traveling waves, in the traveling wave frames, that's really defined by when the things in time have stopped moving. So I just put all these time derivatives and these equations to zero to define traveling waves. Okay? So if I do that, I get these. Well, I can get these equations, which are just ODEs to describe traveling waves. These ODEs depend upon the unknown speed S. So if I can solve these equations or find bounded solutions to these equations, then that's really describing waves. So for the people that know about dynamical systems, traveling pulses are connections to the fixed point in this system, homokinetic orbits. And periodic waves and periodic orbits in this would correspond to traveling wave trains. So maybe all this is a bit technical and I'll speed up through this, but in some sense what I want to do, I'm going to construct waves. Sorry? I'm going to talk about the stability of the actual propagating waves themselves, rather than stability of fixed points now. Okay. So I'm going to try and construct waves, and the way I'm doing it, I'm going to get out waves irrespective of their stability, and I'd like to know mathematically which one of the waves I construct is stable, or which are unstable. So to do that, I'm just going to do a linear stability analysis. I'm going to imagine I've got a traveling wave as a solution to those ODEs, and I'll just call that C naught and H naught. So this is the calcium profile in the traveling wave coordinate, and I've got a traveling wave, and this is the gating variable profile. And I'm going to consider perturbations to that in this traveling wave frame. Maybe I will speed through that because it's not, whoop, not too quick. But anyway, if you consider perturbations of this form, something in the traveling wavefront times e to the lambda t, you can get an eigenvalue problem. Well, this matrix M is given in terms of these partial differential operators, and these A1s and B1s are just coming from the non-linearities of the problem, linearized around the traveling wave solution. So all I'm doing is taking a traveling wave, and I'm putting perturbations onto that traveling wave, and I'm saying, how do those perturbations behave at least to first order? And I do the first order thing by linearizing. So if you were to just look at the instabilities around the fixed point, if you're looking for a homoclinic orbit, which is a pulse, you start quiet and then you rise up and you go down, you go back to another fixed point. If you're just looking at instabilities around the ends, the fixed point, and you're ignoring the shape of the wave, that would be very much like the sort of analysis you do for Turing instability analysis for patterns. And I know there's a lot going on here at the moment about Turing instability analysis for pattern formation. And that will give us, in this case, the so-called essential spectrum or the continuous spectrum. But to linearize around the wave properly, you need to see the shape of the wave. And that gives, when you do the stability analysis properly, you'll see the point spectrum coming up. So let me just jump to the answer in some sense. So there's a model which has diffusion in it, and it's got an IP3 receptor model in it. And I'm looking for traveling waves with a constant speed. And the one I'm going to focus on is a pulse. So I'm going to imagine a propagating pulse moving across the cell. And I want to know how its speed varies as I change the level of IP3. Does it speed up if there's more IP3 or slow down if there's less IP3? And this information is summarized in this diagram somewhere. So what I've got on the bottom is IP3. And up the side, I've got the speed of one of these solitary pulses. A bit of background information, which isn't really physical. This line here, HB, and this line here, HB, are the locus of those two hot bifurcations that I showed in that first bifurcation diagram. But the bit of this graph which shows you about waves is here. So if you just look at this sort of C-shaped here, this is the speed of a solitary pulse in this model. So there are two answers. If you pick a level of IP3 and you find there are two waves, each with a different speed. This S is the speed of the wave. And what I was interested in, well, there's two, so which one would you see in experiments? And this stability analysis I just flagged up allows you to work out that it is the faster of the two branches, which is stable, which is pretty typical in excitable systems.
What's the unit of that?
So the units, if you go back, it's going to be in something like micrometers per second, which is the orders you're looking for. And there are some other interesting features to this. So if you have not enough IP3, you can't get a wave. And if you have too much, there isn't a solitary wave. If you get the right amount, it's a fast one. And as you ramp up IP3, it fails, and it fails up here, and it fails in a rather exotic manner. It gives rise to bifurcations to waves of double pulses and very irregular shape. And if you look at the bifurcation structure up here, then one sees a so-called T-point, which is they're quite relatively rare dynamical systems. And this is really reflecting the fact that for some windows of parameter space, you can get three fixed points. So the homoclinic, the pulse-like solution I was looking for is really a connection from a fixed point to itself. You start off low, you rise up, make a pulse, and get back to where you started. But hanging around in the system are other fixed points. So that orbit can actually bump into these other fixed points that are hanging around. And this T-point is where you get a connection between a saddle and a saddle focus. Anyway, the pictures down here are plots of the spectra. So this is a wave that you might see on this branch, just a spiky thing. That's the profile of the traveling pulse. And this is the real part of the eigenvalues and the imaginary part. And you see whatever, it's either a closed line or a dot, these eigenvalues all lie in the left-hand complex plane. And the condition for stability is that be true, that everything lie in the left-hand complex plane. If you pick an orbit or a traveling pulse on here, you see some of the point spectrum moves over to the right, indicating an instability.
So what are the two lines?
This one and...
No, the lower. spectrum.
Here?
In the essential spectrum.
Oh, yeah, here. This continuous line. Oh, there's a continuous spectrum from that you can plot by hand, because you can do you can linearize by hand around the endpoints, the fixed point, and this is what's picked up by the numerical scheme. So it's either an approximation to the continuous spectrum or is a point spectrum. I don't, depends upon your. Yes, there's what. This one just seems to have, it's purely real, it seems to be. Yeah. Yeah, there don't seem to be any exotic, in some sense, Hopf-type bifurcations of this state.
So this unstable mode, the shape of this unstable mode is the same shape as the class itself.
Yes, that's how I'd interpret it, yeah. Okay, so this... What do the unstable ones look like? Yeah, it just looks the same, it's just got lower amplitude. It's hard to see, this axis, this is 0.09, and this is a stable one, 0.5, but they're both spiky, both pulsy. One seems to... I'm only moving one parameter around in this game. I'm only moving one of the parameters around as well, so you might be able to restabilize it. Okay, so all I want, this has been the rather technical part of the talk, but all I'm saying is that there's this de Jong Kaiser model, standard model, and what does it do? Well, it will support at least solitary pulses with a speed that, you know, if you pick the right IP3 window, you get a traveling pulse. Too big, no pulse, too small, no pulse. And this is how the speed should move. It should get bigger as you increase IP3. So I want now to move to more minimal models that have the same sort of properties. So I had to go through this process to tell you what this more complicated model did. But it was interesting, this bifurcation diagram, I plotted this and then read a paper by Jim Snead and saw the same picture, which was, you always think, oh, well, wasted my time, because some other guys already done the same analysis for the same model. But he'd played with a different model of IP3, which he'd made up, I don't know how. But in his model, the IP3 receptor has two so-called shut states, a shut and an intermediate shut, two opens, an open and another type of open, and some different intermediate states. And he played the same sort of game, went for a sort of a Lee-Rinzel type reduction to get a simpler two-state or a three-state model. And I'm not going to go through the details, but it looks very reminiscent of the equations I had up for the de Jong Kaiser model. And he plotted this bifurcation diagram in his paper to show that maybe, you know, de Jong Kaiser is a generic model of an IP3 receptor because it looks like Jim Snead's, and they weren't designed to be related. So he found the same thing. There's a window of IP3 where you get two pulses. He did numerics to show that it was this guy that was stable. He found this T-point, this sort of loopy Hopf bifurcation structure which periodic waves emerge off of. He also had.
Okay. Why is laboratory simulation of the IP3 some small changes
in the rest of his is 0.2 to 0.25, and mine was only 0.2 to 0.3. So it's all a tiny window. And all this exotic stuff he talked about in his paper, it blows up these pictures. This is infinitesimal in parameter space. So there's a lot of this wave is just a solitary pulse. And there are other waves, for higher IP3 you can have double pulses, triple pulses, far more exotic type traveling wave structures. I'm just focusing on how the pulse would behave in this system. You know, I'm not even talking about periodics, and there are periodic wave trains in this model. So now I want to jump to a simpler model, which is it's a really nice sort of toy model, which is exactly soluble, so it should appeal to mathematicians and physicists. And I want to relate this back to the de Jong Kaiser model and show you that can it do the same sort of thing, but it's much simpler. So this is the so-called fire diffuse fire model that's been worked on by Joel Kaiser, John Pearson, Sylvina Ponce-Dawson, Greg Smith, and others. And this is the form it has. So U is your cytosolic calcium, and it's rate of change of cytosolic calcium is, well, there's some diffusion, it's a whole cell model, same as I just talked about. There's a pump in this model. Instead of being a nonlinear circuit pump, it's just a linear pump. with a time constant tau d. And there's some source terms. So instead of having IP3 receptors which open and let calcium out, you just say, well, look, the puff that comes out of these things is pretty universal. But all we need to know is when a cluster puffs. That's the all important thing, because its shape is universal. So that's a big approximation. It's not one that's made in the Dion-Kars model, for example. So this rho of x describes your distribution of stores. Where are the release sites in your continuum? And this sum over this m is just an integer, these etas here are the puff shapes. So puffs of calcium come out of the stores, and they come out at certain times. So these tms are the times of release of puffs at position x. And then the unknown in the model is, well, when do these stores release? How do I work out these tms? And that's done through a thresholding process, because people are thinking of calcium-induced calcium release. So if the calcium level at a release site reaches a certain threshold, then the system is said to release. And that defines this release time. And then you put this contribution into this. There's no recovery in this. So it's not a good model in that sense, that it will release arbitrarily fast. Yes. Yes. So that would be to need to be bolded on. You would need to add a recovery variable or an ad hoc refractory term. So we can do that. So for this talk, I'm going to take a puff as being on or off for a duration tau r. So yeah, tau r. And it's going to have a strength sigma upon tau r. So it's a pretty naive model of a puff, but we can relax that later on. And these release times are the first time you cross threshold, and you're going increasing through threshold such that your release is after the last time you released. And if you wanted to add refractoriness, you could just bolt on a plus a constant in here for the refractoriness. Yes. So Dion-Kaiser is all about IP3, how the wave speed change with IP3 changes. This minimal FDF model says nothing about IP3. All it's got is a threshold. So how do we relate this model, or turn this model into something that looks a bit more like the Dion-Kaiser? IP3 has got to creep in there somewhere. And the most natural place to put it really is in the threshold. So you might imagine, in some sense, that the more IP3 around in the system, the easier it is to release, so the lower the threshold. But maybe there's a more systematic way of getting that out. So what I've done is just plot the level of calcium in the endoplasmic reticulum is a function of the IP3 that you put onto the system that's sufficient to generate oscillations. And in some sense, that's one way to define a threshold. How much IP3 do you have to put on the system to make the system oscillate? So if you remember, my first bifurcation diagram had stable fixed point, oscillatory regime, stable fixed point, and it's that border to that first oscillatory regime that one could use to define a threshold. So from the Dion-Kaiser model, you can track out the level of calcium in the endoplasmic reticulum you need to get oscillation. So if I were to just color in where oscillations are on this diagram, it would just be above this line. So this is I'm going to say, here's a choice for an IP3-dependent threshold. And I could just use that in my FDF framework. And that's what I'm going to do. And then what else do I need to fix up to make the two models look the same? Well, I need to choose the duration of a puff. Well, I can read that off from Dion-Kaiser or from experiments, and the time scale for a pump, and I can read it off from Dion-Kaiser or trying to fit it, or read it off from experiments. So they're fixed.
How did you get this formula for the
threshold? Oh, this is just a fit. This is not the ride. So this is the plot you get out by numerically tracking where the first hot bifurcation is, and this is just a functional form that fits it. There are obviously others. Now what I need to do is construct traveling waves in the Dion-Kaiser model with this IP3-dependent threshold and see if they look, in the fire diffuse fire framework, and see if they look like the Dion-Kaiser. And if they do, then I'd suggest that this is an easier framework in which to do analysis and in which to pursue mathematics, at least. So for this model to look like the Dion-Kaiser, first I need to choose a distribution of stores. And in the first model, it was just uniform, so I just choose a density of stores is constant, just set it to 1. And the solutions I'm looking at are traveling pulses, so I've now got to work in the language of release times. So that means there's only one release at position x, and it occurs at time x upon v, where v would be the speed of the wave that I'm looking for. So I'm going to put this solution form into my equations of motion, and I'm going to do it on the travelling wave frame. And over here you see, in some sense, the diffusion of the model, a velocity-dependent term, the pump of the model, and that's being driven by a puff. So if you haven't yet had a puff at the position you're at, you get a zero here. If there's a puff, you get a constant term, and if you're outside the puff again, it's a zero term. So there are three regimes. There's this puff. I've said there's something moving across the system, which is a puff, traveling with speed v. What does that cause the calcium profile to look like? Outside the puff, it's just trying to decay back to zero. So outside the puff, this is the two regimes outside the puff, trying to decay back to zero. When it's filling the puff, it's just being driven by the strength of the puff and how long it's on for. So you get this sum of two exponentials plus the constant term. And these n plus or minuses are just given in terms of this unknown velocity v and properties of the model. These coefficients, alpha 1 to alpha 4, these amplitudes of this solution, you just get by demanding continuity of solution and its first derivative. And, you know, they're just matching conditions. So how did you... I've just assumed a wave profile, and I've constructed it, but how fast is it going? So I need a condition to pin down the speed. And all I've just got to remember is, in this model, you know, something has got to rise through threshold to make a puff. So I've just got to check that this solution actually meets threshold, and there'll be a puff in the system. So I can choose an origin such that solution at the origin passes through the threshold. And that's a condition. That's an implicit condition for the unknown, that'll give me the unknown speed of the wave, which I've written out here. So you can get an implicit equation for the unknown speed, which, you balance up the threshold and these tau r's duration of the puff, sigma's its strength, that's the rate of pumping. And it's given in terms of these m plus or minuses or whatever, but they're given in terms of v. So this equation pins down v for you. And if you plot that, here you go. So there's de Jong Kaiser. And here's FDF, and I've only got one free parameter, and that's effectively the threshold in the model. Where do I actually put that? And I've just fiddled around with that. Yes?
What I didn't understand with your moving puff is that you have a traveling wave in the Jung-Kaiser model. You can speak of a left to right moving or right to left moving wave.
Yeah.
And it's clear at any instant in which direction the wave will move. But if you have a puff without any kind of refractoriness, it can, at any snapshot, it can move to either side.
Yeah, yeah, that's right. So I've just picked one moving from left to right. No, not really. I could construct both in the same system.
You could always go left to right, no?
Oh, you mean jiggle?
No.
No, I'm constructing explicitly waves which travel with a constant velocity. Yeah.
If I just look at it, I wouldn't know whether it would be left to right moving.
Oh, so in... Oh yeah, so in the real system, yeah, there's no choice, there's no preferred direction left or right. So if you kicked it in the middle, there would be two, one going left, one going right. Kick it one end, it'll go...
Why should it go left or right? I mean, this is...
No, it'll go left and right.
If you put in something that decays to a travelling wave, it's going to go in a particular direction. I mean, if you put in a front that looks something like that, it's going to pop it, right?
It's
an illusion. It depends on the
initial conditions. But, okay, so I'm not using initial data here. Yeah, I've already assumed it's going from left to right or right to left. I don't care which, because I'm interested in the speed, and that'll be the same in both cases, because it doesn't care about left or right.
Right, if I understand this correctly, if that's what you say, and back in the biological picture that you presented before,
mm-hmm.
Does it mean that all this sophisticated mechanism, or part of this sophisticated mechanism, you can overlook, and what its role is to give you self-consistent moving front.
Yes.
You could replace it by the condition of self-consistent moving thing, then you can ignore it.
Yes. Self-consistency is at the heart of this argument, in some sense. So anyway, this is the two models. So, you know, fire diffuse fire is really simple, and you can introduce your favorite IP3 dependent threshold into this model and get a relatively good, I don't know if you'd call it a fit between the two models or not, but it's got the same qualitative behavior. What's nice is that it's tractable. So now you can use this as a stepping stone to ask more complicated questions about cells, hopefully. And you can even do stability analysis by hand in this model, because I said I'm going to do this for an on-off puff shape, but that in this framework you can have an arbitrary puff shape, because you can write the solution in this form. This is sort of integral, which you might evaluate a contour, which you express in terms of the Fourier transform of the puff shape. So eta is the puff shape, and as long as I know it's Fourier, or as long as it's got a well-defined Fourier transform, I can also write this solution in this formal way. And these epsilons, this thing here, is just coming from your pump and your diffusion. And that's sort of nice, because then you'd say, well, this is the solution. I can linearize around it and do the same thing I did before for the young Kaiser, but I had to do numerically. But in some sense, for people that play with PDEs and look at stability of traveling waves in PDEs, you can construct the so-called Evans function for this system. But basically, there's an equation with lambda in it. And if you can evaluate this equation, you can do it by doing the appropriate contour. And look at lambda and ask the question, is the real part of this positive or negative? You can determine stability. So here's an equation for lambda. If the real part of this lambda is negative, then the wave is stable. And you find out that, yes, as in Dion Kaiser, it's this fast upper branch which is stable, and the lower one is unstable. But that's just more technical fun. Now I want to move to what I consider more getting more realistic. You know, the cells aren't, well, they're not translation invariant, that's for sure. The stores are probably at discrete sites somewhere in the ER or the SR. So let's see if we can play with this phi diffuse phi model, as other people have done, when the distribution of stores is at on a lattice. So there's a physical separation between clusters. So D is the spacing between clusters. Same model. Can you analyze it? Yes, you can. And again, we play the same game. I'm going to look for a particular type of solution, one in which there's a release event here, there's a bit of diffusion, a bit, you know, some later time, there's another release event, diffusion, a later time again, there's another release event, so on. So the release times, I'm going to say, occur at some multiple of some fundamental time, which is the delay between a puff being offered up here and then again here. So I can define a speed, which is just the distance between release units divided by this period between puffs. Then the solution can be expressed in closed form again, because this delta Dirac sequence picks out certain spatial points. So I just get a sum over all the points in the system where there's a release site. And then I've got to worry about the puff shape, which is the source, and that's just on or off for me. So that means there's an integration over time, which is only over the window of the duration of the puff. So this tau r here is the duration of the puff. And this g is the so-called Green's function of the system without sources. And the system without sources is a linear PDE. It's the cable equation, well known in nerve conduction theory, and it has a well-known Green's function. Yeah, so far I've just assumed a solution form, and again, I don't know what this delta is or really what this speed is, so I have to have a self-consistency condition to get it. What's nice about this is that you have this sort of relationship. If you pick your solution and move up a lattice spacing and a time of interpuff intervals and subtract from it where you started from, it's just equal to basically the integral of your Green's function over the duration of the puff. And you can use this to get your solution in the rather nice form, it'll come up, because that H can be evaluated in closed form. And then you can look for this self-consistent condition. In some sense, what you imagine, you've got this continuum. Every now and again, you've got a store, and you assume this store releases a time delta later, the next store releases, and so on down the chain. And you better make sure that the guy at the end is able to release under this assumption. So you just look to the right to the end of your chain. You take the calcium density right at the end of your chain, so n is the end of the chain, and you check that's store release, so it got to threshold. Because if it didn't, then nobody else will. And these u's you can express in terms of these h's, which you know, they're just, if you can integrate the Green's function of the undriven system over the duration of a puff, you can work out what h is and do that sum. Maybe that sum is quite hard, but this is the equation for the speed. And again, let me just plot it and show you how it differs from the continuum model. So if you do that, if I plot the threshold in the system as a function of the interpuff interval, You see, if the threshold's too high, you know, you can't reach threshold, you can't puff, there's no waves. If the threshold's low enough, you get two answers, and the one with the lowest inter-puff interval, lowest delta, is the stable one. So that's the faster of the two waves, like it was for the other models. But the waves look different. So let me just show you a movie of how the wave would look as it just sort of marched through space. So this is a movie in time, plotting the calcium profile. So you can see every time there's sort of a jump up, something is diffused across the release site and a puff has been released. And then the system moves again, calcium diffuses, hits another release site, there's another puff, and off it goes. So there isn't a travelling wave frame, because you can't run along and see the same profile, but there is a well-defined speed, which is sort of nice. So what have we got? Computationally simple model that you can study with, you know, hopefully arbitrary distributions. You know, we did the continuum, we did a regular lattice, probably you can do others. It's got nice, interesting travelling waves, but it's computationally cheap. So this is good for simulation. So maybe I want to get into 2D or 3D and have, you know, geometries of release clusters or whatever. So it'd be good to have a computation cheap model. And this is computation cheap, but you can make it cheaper if the puff is really simple, if it's on or off. So let me show you what I'm thinking of. So in some sense, the transport is all on the left. So I've got evolution in time, how the calcium moves in time. I've got a linear pump instead of a nonlinear circuit pump, and I've got a bit of diffusion. All that's being driven by the puffs in the system, and the puffs occur at release sites. The release sites are they're on the lattice. They don't have to be on a regular lattice. They just are in this example. And if you're at a lattice site and there's a puff, then you're going to feel a source. So these A's here are either ones or zeros. You're either puffing or you're not puffing. So all you have to do is work out, are you puffing or not puffing? And then that fixes up this model. And what I'm thinking of is to look on this model, just sample the system at the puff, multiples of the puff times. Because if you're looking at it, if your system starts to puff and you look at it, and you know it's going to be on for a puff duration, you don't need to look over the next duration of the puff, because you know it's a constant. So as long as the sources are just puffing on or off, you get a very simple model. So I'm just going to look at this system and determine the sources over an interval which is one puff duration, and then keep looking over one puff duration. So I'm going to, it's like a discrete time fire diffuse fire. But fire diffuse fire is computationally expensive because you have to accurately determine when you cross thresholds. You need, you know, that firing time is a real valued number. And this, maybe it's enough to know whether you're thresholding or not, whether you're puffing or not puffing. So I'm going to say these indicator functions, I'm going to move away a bit from the fire diffuse fire framework, and just say these A's at site N, this index is where the release sites are, at some integer multiple of the puff duration, so P is no longer IP3, unfortunately, it's just a counting number. You're either above threshold or you're not. So here's a threshold condition. The activity at site N at this time has got to be above threshold, and this theta is just a step function. Okay? The question about refractoriness is raised, and I can bolt that on now, because I just say, well, if you were above threshold in previous time steps, then I don't want you to be on. You're just going to cross that guy out. Okay? So I can look back over a refractory time scale. So R is just, now typically for these systems, the refractory time scale is about 50 times the duration of a puff, so I believe. So it's sensible to make R about 50. But you just look back over 50 time steps, and if you're puffing on those 50, then you're not allowed to puff anymore. There are no sources. So it's computationally cheap, because all you have to do is discrete time sampling, and you check this condition, are you above threshold or not? Moreover, this guy, you don't even have to evolve it as a PDE, because you can integrate out the transport between sites, because it's a linear PDE. So you can write actually the solution in closed form. In terms of initial data, you have to convolve up your initial data in space, so that's a bit of a pain. But your solution can be written in terms of these functions H, which the same H as we had last time, they're just the integral of your Green's function, which we already know, over some time window, which for us is going to be duration of a puff, and then you just have to work at these A's. So this is like a sort of a basis function expansion. There is a preferred basis for this problem, these H's, and they're centered around the release sites, they're the spatially preferred sites, and around the puff times. So you just need to know if you're puffing or not. Okay, so computationally cheap model, and here's here's a result of just plotting out that here's a numerical solution of that computationally cheap model. And as we said, you know, left, right, whatever. If we kick it in the middle, you know, I expect something to go left and right. So in some sense, this is one of those lurchy waves I showed from the movie, but it's just plotted in the space-time diagram. So sort of the white and red are sort of red is sort of high activity, and you see activity jumping from one release site to the other. So you can see where the release sites are. These things here, and this is where I've gratuitously ripped off someone else's work. Just here's a line scan. It's, you know, the line scans really show this sort of structure. Well, you do see sort of stuff jumping across. So this would be space and this would be time in the line scan. Okay, so computation cheap model, we can do 1D things, we can probably do 2D, and we'll do that shortly, but really, this isn't noisy. Real cells are pretty noisy. So where's the appropriate point in this model to introduce noise? And that's probably for us at the thresholds. Let's assume that the thresholds are the appropriate place to represent noise. So instead of having a constant threshold, I'm going to have a threshold which is jiggled around by a bit of noise. And then the model goes over, this computation cheap model goes over, and instead of working, you know, instead of me checking whether A is 1 or 0 from a deterministic condition, I just say, what's the probability of A being 1? What's the probability of a puff at a release site? And that's sort of nice, because the probability of a puff at a release site for me, because I've jiggled the threshold by noise, I just count up the number of times noise induces thresholding behavior. So the probability of being above threshold is just given by the integral of the distribution of noise over this perturbed deterministic condition. Or if you don't like that, you can just say, what's the probability of being above threshold? What's the probability of release? What's the probability of puff? And ask an experimentalist, and he can tell you what's the probability of release as a function of background calcium levels, maybe. So it's just a functional of background calcium. So this F and this rho are related. So hopefully you could derive this from a biophysical model or ask an experimentalist for this and see if they're the same. But I just looked in the literature and it was suggested, well, reading this paper by Isa and probably there are many others, that the probability of release follows some functional form. So the more calcium there is, the higher the probability of release for fixed RP3. So I'm just going to choose this functional form to have sigmoidal shape. So for low calcium, the probability of release is low, and for high calcium, the probability is high, and I'm just going to smoothly join the two in some sort of sigmoid. I'm going to parameterize my sigmoid by beta. So for small beta, you've got a sort of a shallow curve, and for large beta, you've got a very, very steppy on-off type relationship. Low calcium, it's off, high calcium, it's on. Which implies for this sigmoidal form that the distribution of noise I'm really considering is this sort of bell-shaped. So the threshold is being perturbed by bell-shaped noise. And now we can play the same game again. I've got this computation cheap model. It's got noise in it. Does this look like a wave in a line scan? Well, again, I've, you know, somebody else's line scan. And reminiscent at least. So this noise is maybe capturing something at some level about noisy behavior of cells with discrete release sites.
Before you go on, what's propagating the signal that means? So you're just kicking it,
that burns the initial plot. Yeah, I didn't say it, but you're quite right. So I just kick in the middle and see what happens. Just a tiny, push one of the guys to release. You know, there was some activity going this way and it failed. And then it seems, in some sense, maybe this is connected to this, but whatever, this is either a spontaneous event or one that's induced by this one. This propagates to the left, and then fails. This one seems to be truly spontaneous. It's a long way from any activity. Doesn't go anywhere. This one doesn't go left very far, but goes right, you know. Yeah, that's right. So every time you update the system, and you're drawing the threshold from its distribution, so it is changing.
And that's with refractoriness.
Yes. So you can see that the time scale from here to here is dominated, but you know there's nothing in here because refractoriness is dominating the system. Okay. In a deterministic description, there could be no events over a refractory time scale. In this model, there can be release events within a refractory time scale because it's noisy. Okay, but they're just rare. So
so
maybe it's trying, you know, determining, if I turn the noise down, it may try and form a, you know, you might think, oh, there might be a periodic wave there. And the period of that wave will be dominated by the refractory time scale.
I guess I'm asking, do you have to start this?
No, you could just wait. You could just wait. Because the thresholds are noisy, so at some stage the threshold is going to go way down. And then, depending on your where you start the system at rest, it can induce a release event. You just have to wait long enough when it's noisy. Now, Martin's walked out the room, and I was going to hopefully get him to help me out on this, but Martin's played around with models of calcium release with transport and clusters and release sites and noise, and he found out that the model he played with exhibited a form of so-called directed percolation. So I just wanted to say that this model has the same sort of phenomena in it, so I just have to tell you what directed percolation is. So in some sense there's a lot of interest in directed percolation in the physics community because it's the new playing ground for, you know, testing out ideas about non-equilibrium phenomena. Physicists used to play with things like the icing model because it was a testing ground for equilibrium phenomena. Now they've moved on to non-equilibrium stuff, and this is the model they typically play with, or one of the models they play with. So we can imagine sort of a discrete space model which propagates with dynamics which propagates forward in time with simplistic update rules, such that, well, you might want to put a sort of a 1 or a 0 at these sites and then propagate these activities through time. You might say, well, if there was a 1 here at time 0, then if my neighbors are on and I roll a dice and it comes out to be less than, you know, some sort of random number generator, it turns out to be less than some fixed value p, then in the next iterate, I stay on. So simple updating rules with probabilistic things built in. But all I want to point out is this is a simple model with this P here. And what people find is if you put some activity on the system and play this game, evolve this system forward in time, if P is less than some critical value, you know, stuff doesn't always propagate forward in time. It dies out. Everything goes to zero state. If you pick this P big enough, then initial activity here, say, propagates forward and survives for a long time, which is suggestive of some sort of border between propagating and non-propagating. So you might be able to tune the system to a critical P, or some sort of critical noise, where you see interesting scaling behavior for these waves. Let's call them waves. And the physicists have conjectured that at the critical point, the survival probability follows a power law, which is universal among models that belong to this class of directed percolation model. So the survival probability, how long you survive for, should for large time scale as a power law of an exponent delta, and this delta is universal for a number of models. And Martin found in his calcium model that he got out this universal delta. And if you play the same game with this phi diffuse phi model with this type of noise, you can tune up the noise to get between a border between propagating and non-propagating stuff, and if you look at the power law for the survival of waves, you see the same sort of scaling as in directed percolation. Which is sort of nice because the physicists have been playing with toy models to see these scalings, these universal scaling laws, but as far as I'm aware, there aren't any real experiments where these numbers come out. They haven't thought of an experiment how to show directed percolation. So it may be that they should turn to cell biology and see if there's a big enough cell with a large enough system of stores that will have waves propagate for long enough to see if they can find directed percolation. That would be one of the first applications of this non-equilibrium statistical mechanics. So, see Martin, but he's not here. Okay, so no more equations, just some movies now. So here's a 2D model. There's no restriction in this model about where you put the sites. I've just put them on a regular array. So I can't remember, maybe there's 50 by 50 sites in a regular way, or maybe it's 100 by 100. It's probably 50 by 50. And you can get things like, you can kick the system in the middle and get an expanding circular front. It's a little bit irregular because I put noise in the system. So it looks noisy because I put noise in. It's not because there's an irregular array of release sites. Which is fine, but that's what you expect. That's what this model is sort of designed to do. Whoops. You can also get more exotic behavior like spirals and patterns. So again, you can kick it in the middle and you see some nucleation and then some fronts with a bit of curvature with spirals, lots of sites nucleating at once, and refractoriness kills off waves that bump into each other. So in some sense it's just eye candy, it's just movies for the sake of movies. This is what we expected. What I want, the idea of this approach is minimal models. You play with them, you do maths on them. Do you get anything new out? There's nothing new coming out yet, really, apart from the fact that it entertains mathematicians, maybe. So what am I going to get now? Is just imagine I'm in a situation where deterministically nothing happens. I just want to get to the effects of noise. What can noise do in these models? So I want you to imagine that if I take this model and turn off the noise, so the threshold is just chosen, it's deterministic, and I evolve the system. If I kick it, I'm going to be in a regime where nothing would happen. You know, you can't reach threshold in any sense, and waves would just die out. So I'm in a situation where deterministically the cell would do nothing if you kicked it. It hasn't got parameters adjusted correctly to give you waves and such like. Now imagine that you start to turn on noise, so that any phenomenon you do see must be solely attributable to noise. This is what you see. So again, you can see a spreading circular front, much like in the sort of noisy deterministic case. And then after a while, you see, you can see it, but it's very coherent motion where the release sites conspire to release all at the same time, and then the cell behaves as some sort of giant oscillator with this very coherent behavior. That's just due to the noise. Okay, so I prepared the system. If I turn off the noise, it's just a deterministic sort of excitable model, one which produces spirals and circular fronts. But in this model, there's a bit of noise somewhere, and it's in the thresholds, but maybe that's not important. So deterministically, there's no noise. I kick it, you know, put a little initial bump here, it would just spread out and die. Nothing will happen. Now I turn up the noise. It could be a very large noise level. So, you know, the thresholds are moving around a lot, so sometimes it's very easy to release. And that noise can support spreading fronts, like the deterministic case. But after that, once the system has been primed, so in some sense, a wave moves through the system, and there's high calcium everywhere, so you're left above threshold. But you can't fire because you're refractory. There's a refractory model. If you wait about a refractory time step, then if you look everywhere, then because you're really highly above threshold after the first priming event, you're still above threshold, so you can go off. You're primed to go off.
The timings of that limit is burst of activity. They seem to be high, it's short moving, almost regular.
Yeah, it's very, very, very regular. So if you... If you define an average activity, I haven't plotted it, but if you average the activity over all the release sites and plot it, it's a very well defined periodic variable.
I guess it was puzzling, I didn't expect it to be so synchronized, because the only thing that I can think of in experimentals is like a fibrillating part. You know, once something gets, you know, zapped, everything is on its own, so why is it all synchronized?
Yeah, so this is the question. This is really what I want to get to. I mean, this is just this is what this model does with a bit of noise, and I'm not really sure if real cells do that. How does a real cell generate global cooperative periodic behavior?
What if you lack the part of the model that included the refractory period? It's very fixed. We have 50 units for all the components.
Yeah, so my refractory...
You relax it and then introduce noise, so some places in the different refractory periods of different locations. Would it also be synchronized?
Well, the refractory period in this is somehow noisy as well, because the way I've written it...
Okay, because of the threshold that is...
Yeah, because I've written the refractoriness, it used to be, you know, just a purely threshold term. Are you above threshold times a product of terms? Maybe I'll just go back to it.
Maybe a comment here. That exactly, that has been granted in a particular group of matches, and they just do the same pattern. And they distribute the quantity spatially, and then they say it's consistent. So it doesn't have to be a matching.
Yeah, this is the model I start with, the deterministic model. I just turn these threshold, these step functions into functions, smooth functions. That's all I've done. So in the stochastic model, there isn't a well-defined refractory timescale anymore. It's loose. You can see if you steepen up this function, it will look more like the deterministic refractory timescale. Yeah, it's maybe a bad thing to do. I mean, it's just then I only need one parameter to have noise on the threshold and the refractoriness. You can unravel it. In the simulations, it's just there are no stores at the edges, so it just sort of goes, it just dies off. But if you wanted to plot, you wanted to say, oh, I've got this oscillator, how does its frequency change with noise? And this beta controls my noise. So if you haven't got enough noise, there's no oscillation. So this is the frequency of oscillation. And as you increase noise, the frequency sort of goes up quite, the frequency of the global averaged variable goes up quite nicely. So it'd be nice to sort of derive that or establish its behavior anyway. So this is it. So all I've done is played with somebody else's model, the Young-Kaiser model, and then I played with somebody else's model, the fire diffuse fire model, and I've added a bit of noise and shown some movies. But hopefully I've convinced you, maybe this is a, if you want to talk about wholesale behavior, where it's very hard to take complicated models of the details and have lots, you know, have a wholesale model. Maybe these simpler models that just work in terms of thresholds and noise are the way to go. And then, of course, the hope would be that you could derive these thresholds from your favorite biophysical model. You know, you would have these, you would make these links back to the details. And the noise, you'd like to derive that from the receptor models. I mean, these, you know, if I only have a few number, the fewer the number of receptors in the cluster, the more noisy it is in some sense. So maybe there's some sort of idea, some stochastic phase analysis that one could use. And then, because I've got noisy things, then I can talk about spark localization in stochastic model, which might be interesting in terms of cardiac myocytes, where you maybe don't want spreading waves. And then all these other interesting things that are thrown up from cell biology. Some, you know, for example, in atrial myocytes, there's a notion of eager sites. Some sites like to go off more, release more than others. And I've got this thing, I can control that by just having a distribution of thresholds in the model. And then I can look at the interplay between the distribution of thresholds and the actual distribution of stores and see how that gives rise to physiologically significant waves. And then, of course, it's all very simple. You know, there's no circuit pumps, there's no mitochondria. Isn't that whatever you think, it's not in here. It's just thresholds and noise and diffusive transport. There's no buffering. So I'll stop there.
I'm confused about your global synchronization. These things are all coupled to diffusive.
Yeah, so then.
So, let me make sure I'm not confused about something. How many oscillations can you see? Can you see 10,000, or can you just see 10?
This seems to persist.
Seems to persist.
Yeah.
Even though it's only a piece of the cell.
Yeah. Well, there's continuous release. I mean, once you fire release once, you know that that's another source. So every time you release, there sources are coming from release. Oh, so I'm not saying I have the answer, though. This is the phenomena I see from this model. I'm just saying it's a nice phenomenon. Why, this is robust, and why does this system like to synchronize so quick? And it synchronizes very, very quickly as well. Yeah, I haven't. There's no correlations in the noise between sites. I just at each site, I just choose the noise from a distribution at each time step.
But it is very in time.
Yeah. Because each time I update the system, I compare my activity to the threshold, and I draw the distribution of noise. I draw the noise from a distribution. Yeah.
you translate the frequency, it seems to saturate at some frequency 1.5 or something in the units of the
hertz.
The time between discreteness and the diffusion time, what does it correspond to?
So what sets this time scale?
Yeah, 1.5. What is the time scale?
The only time scale in the system which is about a second is the refractory.
You have the refractory and you have the lens between the sides and you have the diffusion.
Yeah. Yeah, those are all a lot smaller than the refractory time scale. So refractory time scale is about a second. So this is yeah, it's about this refractory time, which isn't, you know,
it's saturates to a level and then
then you have to wait. Yeah.
Charges again.
Yeah, that's the way I interpret it. But why it synchronizes so well so quickly? It's probably because it's a threshold phenomenon. If everywhere is above threshold, it doesn't matter what distribution you have on the calcium above threshold, because it's just, are you above it, are you below it? And that's how they can all go bang.
Just a comment on it, you can see the same behavior in any excitable system if you add noise. You take a 1500 room where you add noise, you see all the same panel.
Yep. Yep.
So you see the global synchronization, which is actually not that good. If you look at the phases there, they're quite spread.
Okay. Yeah, this is in some sense, I don't want this to be a surprise. I just want to say, here's a model which I'm trying to sort of bootstrap up from more cell biology based models, and it does the same thing. I mean, in some sense, that's why the physicists are great to go to these excitable models plus noise. What's different about this model is that the interactions are not fixed, they're state dependent because it's coupled through diffusion. I'm not adding noise to state variables, it's going into an internal parameter. So I'm trying to put in the interactions and the noise at the appropriate places. But you're right, you see the same stuff. But, I don't know if this is how the experimental community think. Do the people think, oh, it's beneficial to have noise, and can I make things oscillate with noise, or can I get synchrony with noise? Yeah, I thought that you know it's noisy, but can a noise help you? Can it do things like make a global rhythm? Yeah. That's right.
If you have a different distribution of noise, what can happen is you get one site.
Oh yeah. Yeah, this model you could easily adapt it to have your preferred focal site or your preferred cluster which forms a focal site, isn't it?
If you take an analogy to neural networks, you can have a model of neural networks. You have the neurons that fire the
It's exactly the same. There's just no reset in this.
Synchronized burst, of course. But the intervals between the bursts have a long-term distribution. They are not periodic. But it depends on the type of model you're seeing for the neuron. If you take an integrated fire model, which corresponds to your way, I now go back to the very presented. Translate the fact that you take one state element, then you get something which is almost periodic. But if you take the elements and you add additional degree of freedom, you get the bursts that have some distribution
right. Yeah, I mean, integrating fire without refractoriness is going to behave differently to the second type of model.
Then what you do then, you add the sort of memory to each of the elements or to each location. That's usually a detail that you average over neural model, right? To understand it correctly.
Sorry.
Each place that you have a path, if you take the detailed model, has some memory.
Yeah.
And you took out.
That's out. You're exactly right. Yeah.
So in the neuron, if you take it out and you use the integrated fire model to describe the neuron, you get the bursts, which are almost regular space, like in the case that you back each element some local element of memory, then you get them distributed.
Yeah, I mean, you could do the same thing here. You could keep the recovery variable like we did in the Jung-Kaiser. It's just one-dimensional. Or you could, as people do in integrating fire, they go to an adapting threshold. So you reach threshold, and the threshold is arbitrarily adjusted to high. Yes, yes. Yes. Yeah. Yeah. This is the noise. So it's getting more noisy this way.
When you mentioned the noise would be generated by Q channel in the classroom, how would the noise level go
with number? Well, I imagine as the number goes down, the noise would go up.
Okay.
So that's as good as I can get it. But that's a, I mean, that'd be nice to sort of try and start from cluster-based models where you see n, and see if you can make them look like noisy thresholds and something. Because a lot of people view them as excitable systems. You know, you can see the phase plane, and the noise is pushing you around between the slow and fast manifolds. And it, maybe that's a route to constructing distributions of noise that then can go into this framework.
Thank you.